With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Jokes with Mark Simmons, a podcast where I chat to another comedian about jokes that they can't get to work. As always, I am joined by producer Joel.
Hello, presenter Mark.
So, presenter Mark, I like that. Thanks for quite often comedians on their profiles and stuff, they put comedian, writer and presenter, and they I don't think many have ever presented. I did that and I hadn't ever presented. When like probably a month after I started comedy, I put that.
Nice.
It's so funny. I used to tell everyone I was a comedian. I wasn't. It was a hobby.
And how do you feel? Were you more confident telling people you're a comedian then than you are now?
I don't feel I need to tell anyone now. But yeah, back then, true. I wanted everyone to know that I was doing this cool thing, but I suppose, I don't know.
You're not doing it anymore really though, are you?
I'm doing it online quite a lot, Joel. I'm doing Zooms.
How are they going?
Good, thanks. Yeah. I had a birthday party one the other day.
Nice.
Yeah, doing someone's birthday party.
That's fun.
You'd think that would be a bit weird, just me and six people that know each other and I don't.
Yeah.
But no, it was great. I sort of did know them a little bit.
What sort of stuff did you do?
I did some jokes.
Like a set? Yeah.
I did a lot of chat, but yeah, it was just nice. I was only booked for 20. I did about, I don't know, 35 minutes, I think. It's just fun.
There you go, listeners. If you're thinking about booking someone for a Zoom gig, how about that?
Yeah,
over delivering.
What about that for value for money?
Yeah, exactly. Bloody hell. I bet they're trying to get... They wanted to get rid of you by the end of it. They were looking at their watches.
They were, actually. But yeah, it's just... They just left the call. It's just me. But it's just nice to have some company, Joel.
Yeah, I bet. What else have you been up to, Mark?
What else have I been up to, Joel? Had a bit of drama on TikTok.
Oh, no. What happened? Did they find out your age and kick you off the platform? You're so... Whenever I make a joke, isn't the first rule of, like...
First rule of...
Among comedians is that you've got to laugh along. Isn't that the thing?
Yeah. But I think it's quite funny just being...
What you've done to me there is so mean.
Yes. What was the question? Oh, TikTok. Yeah, so I logged on and they basically found out my age and kicked me off the platform.
What happened?
it was a little bit to do with my age, actually. Genuinely was.
Okay.
I went on there and it just came up your date of birth. I was like, oh God, more things to fill out. Yes, fine, 12 for the first, and click go. And I was like, oh shit, I put 2020. So I was born a couple of days before. And then it just shut the whole thing down. And it went... Basically, we're clamping down on people underage using TikTok. So your site is...
You're four days old.
I'm 4 days old. And they thought, he's too young for this. He needs to be, like, feeding... I don't know what babies do. That's what they do, isn't it? Feed.
Yeah.
They said it was taken off for 30 days and... That after 30 days it'll be deleted permanently. It's very harsh.
Wow, yeah.
And then so I sent some emails, you know, I've got connections. Yeah. And contacted Twitter, TikTok, and they said they're American based, so get in touch with the European leg of TikTok. And it's basically, I got an email today and it's all A-OK.
Great. What a relief.
Back online. Good as gold, Joe. That was a bit of drama. That's the most drama I've had for a while.
Quite exciting, though.
Good to be back. Good to be back on TikTok.
Absolutely.
Going to go TikTok Always live nice, straight after this.
Are you?
No, I wasn't planning on it. I could do it at some point. I don't know. I feel a bit tired today, Joel.
Yeah, it's just difficult, isn't it, sometimes?
One of those days. Yeah. But, you know, it's nice to see you.
You too, mate. You too.
So what who have we got this week, Joel?
We've got Mr. Martin Moore.
Martin Moore?
More.
Is that a song?
How do you like him? Yeah, of course it's a song. More.
Yeah. But you, I know that now.
No, not yet.
I know that now. You said the rest of the words, but you hadn't sold it as a song, so I couldn't pick up what song it was.
Sorry, mate.
You should have went, more.
Yeah, I should have
done. And then I'd have got it.
Hey, listen up, Mark. You wait for the outro.
Oh, I can't wait. We're going to do it in a minute as well. But everyone listening has got to sit through a bloody interview with Martin Moore before they get that gold. here's Martin Moore. Enjoy it. So with stuff like, so do you find that happens often with a bit that the audience don't understand the reference? Because that can be, that's what I find that really annoying, because you could have a perfectly good joke or bit that if they don't get what you're talking about, the topic, that it just doesn't work.
Okay, so now I kind of have a thing where often at gigs, because I'm trying now to present things from a different viewpoint, so that gives me the freedom to explain the thing if they don't get it. So now I know if they don't get it. So if I was talking about, I don't know, I can't think of an example off the top of my head, but if I was talking about something that we would do in Ireland, but I know you don't in England, well, I'll just tell you that we do that in Ireland. And because of the style of show I do, people like that. Like mine thing is very much showing people into another world is very much what I'm trying to do.
So, yeah, because with me, with one-liners, by the time I've explained what they need to know, it's way too long for the payoff.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're taking them on a journey, they'll be on board and they're learning.
Yeah. But it does, the payoff does have to be, if you've got, so I'm going to say for me, it's different from person to person, but for me, if there were like in a 5-minute bet, if there were three of these little explaining bets, even if they're really brief explanations, that needs to have a really big payoff to make it worthwhile. Yeah. It needs to be really justified. If there's just a little one and I go, so I say something, oh no, you don't say that, you say such and such, that could really work. It's like adds texture to it, doesn't it?
Yeah. So would you find that if the payoff wasn't quite big enough, would you say, like for a club, you go, that's definitely not big enough, but with an Edinburgh show, because it's spread out and you don't always have to have those big hits, could you put a bit like that in an Edinburgh show, but you wouldn't put it in?
Well, so it does vary. So sometimes I've done, as a challenge, a couple of times I tried to do Edinburgh shows at club pace, and it's funny and it works, but it exhausts the audience club pace. So what I've done the last 5 or 6 Edinburghs is most of the editing is taking jokes out and trying to make it more interesting. So trying to, whereas with clubs, you're trying to get more jokes in.
Oh, wow.
I'm trying to edit jokes out so that so it's more interesting. The goal is to be interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's completely different to anything I do. Because for me, it can only be jokes. I can't really make it interesting in that sense.
You do that thing. You do something that I very much like. We haven't worked together very many times. But when I saw I follow you on Instagram, and I've looked at those videos that you have up where there's an audience interaction.
Oh, yeah.
And that thing that you do that I observed, we did New Year one year, didn't we, together in Nantwich? Oh,
2020, yeah.
What was that this year?
Yeah, it was. That seems like a long time ago now, doesn't it?
Oh, man, doesn't it?
We had so much hope that night.
Yeah. Jesus. But yeah, that thing that you do, where you have that interaction with the audience and then sometimes you're improvising, and then sometimes you've got a bit of material that looks like you're improvising, but it's
That's what I do. You're right. That's what I do to stop it being just gag. Mm. And that's my favourite bit because that keeps me on my toes.
Yeah, those bits, but you know those moments, those little moments, they're the bits I value the most in a sense. Mm. They're the bits I value the most, and they're also the bits that disappear so easy. Like nobody really remembers. They make the show. They make the show different. They elevate a show, but nobody remembers those bits. They drift away. Here's an interesting thing. Sometimes I think we don't remember those bits either because we're so in that moment.
Mm.
Quite a few years ago, I did the Cape Town Comedy Festival, and I'd been given a camera by a TV company in Northern Ireland to make an in-house pilot. They wanted to do a travel show with me. I was going to
Cool.
This for a little pilot. And my mate Carl was there, and Carl Cooper is, do you know Carl Cooper? He's a BBC.
I don't think so.
Producer. He makes a Mark Steele show, and he's great.
Oh, cool.
Stuff. He's like a comedy genius, this guy. And anyway, So Carl was there, and we were after the event, after the festival, we were going to go on holiday together, and we're going to make this thing. So to get to learn how to use the camera they'd given us, like they were big clunky video cameras then, and to use the video camera, he just filmed my bit of the show every night. We're there for 3 weeks, 12 minutes a night, 1,000 people in a theatre, doing the show, and as I say, I tried to do 5 to 10% improvised, or at least, you know, improvised within material. And at one point, about 2 weeks, they said, "You've got to watch this." And I don't like watching myself on video. He said, "You've got to watch this." And he played me back some clips that he had edited of the video that were really fun improvised bits, audience interaction. I had no memory of doing it. And I'm clearly doing it, laughing my head off. I'm clearly having a brilliant time. And no memory of any of them. Isn't that weird?
Wow. And they're the best bits for them to use for something like that because you're not burning anything.
You're not burning any material. I wish now, so Tom Stead, the Canadian comedian, Tom and I have talked a lot about Joe. It's surprising that, I'm surprised that not more comedians talk like this together, like in dressing rooms and stuff.
Yeah, I love it. But some comedians don't like talking about jokes for some reason.
As if it's cheating, as if thinking about it is cheating or something.
But if you watch any documentary of like American stand-ups, all the big names, whenever I see backstage stuff, I love it because they're all talking about bits. I love that bit you do with that. Oh, I was thinking I could do this with it. Mm. And it seems like more of that culture there, whereas here it seems like you can't discuss your secrets. Or
it's almost like it seems that you're supposed to just get up and be funny. And
I love the culture of it. That's the fun bit, I think, the process.
When I came from, I'd been a professional circus act for over 10 years before I ever did any stand-up. And in circus, it was very like that the young act, so when I was a young act and I worked with like an older juggler, I would pester them. I would say, "How did you do that?" I'd bring them a cup of coffee and say, "There's a cup of coffee for you. How did you?" And sweet talk into letting me know things. And even when you do a night, and there's like not necessarily even like me or you, but when there's like sometimes there's stand-ups on that are such a great stand-up, and talking to the open spot, and they say to you, "Oh yeah, you know such and such, they're my idol. I really love them. They're great." And you go, "Ask them a question," and they're going, "No, you ask them about something. Ask me about something."
But everyone's too polite.
Yeah, weird, isn't that? I think it came, you know, that thing that So there's a bit of a culture even about this still. So I did a Zoom recently. And so I'm sitting here in this little room and we do the sound check and everything. And then I said to the others, so it's starting in like 10 minutes. And I said, Zoom gate. And I said, excuse me, I'm just going to go and get changed. And everybody else was taking the piss out of me going, "What are you getting changed?" And I was going, "Getting changed into my show clothes." You're in your hat. And I was going, "Yeah, but I'm doing a show." And I couldn't believe that. Yeah, weird. I don't know. Different strokes, isn't it? Different strokes.
Yeah, that's how you get into your mindset. That's how you know, it's not just about what you look like either. Because you feel like, "All right, I'm ready for the show now."
So,
because some people do that with, some people bring a different shirt, but it's almost identical to what they're wearing, but they still go and put it on in a live show.
I think it was, as a circus act, we always had costumes. And at one point, one point when I was quite new, I had a kind of Vegas-y two music Shazam kind of juggling act. And that act, I wore a smart black trousers and a white tuxedo. I didn't have a beard, a red bow tie. And then I had a comedy juggling routine. And for that, I wore green trousers, a white shirt, and a waistcoat. And I remember at one point I was booked to do the comedy. I booked through an agent to do the comedy routine. And when I turned up there, I thought I was going to do the Vegas one, the white tuxedo one. And I turned up with the wrong costume. And they said, we're looking for the comedy routine. We're looking forward to the comedy routine. And when I had to do my comedy routine in the wrong jacket, they didn't know. The audience didn't know. But to me, it felt so weird. It felt like I was holding the mic with the wrong hand or something. It just felt weird.
That's funny. I liked, when I do a normal gig, I always like to wear some sort of jacket.
Hmm.
But when I do new material, I don't like using a jacket. I like there to be, I like a different feel. I like the new material to just be t-shirt or relaxed hoodie. I don't know why that is. I think maybe it's, I want more of that kind of, I don't care as much vibe with the new material. So it looks like you're not trying too hard.
So at the new material ones, I probably still change into my, I don't do a lot of new material nights, to be honest, but because in normal life, I'm a resident compere at the Stand. And I bought this bit at the start. I can try stuff in the comparing. I always do material when I'm comparing. I never just do crowd work. So I have opportunities to do that anyway. But if I do a new material, I always take on the notes, and I never read from them, but I always have it in my hand, even if it was, you know, like I was nearly ready to go with them, and I don't need to look at all. I take it on. And I think it's a good. I think it's a good practice to do that.
I think so. And also they give you a little bit of leeway, I think, if you have, because if you don't have notes and you're just doing it like a proper set, and if a bit doesn't work, they could lose total confidence in you for all the next bits. And then you're not being judged properly on the next bits because they've lost confidence. Whereas if you've got notes, they know each joke's an individual new idea.
And they might like that. I think people like to see the work in progress. But what's your thoughts on this? So I'm very, very against. So I'm against when you see people that are using the comedy circuit as a step towards the TV, and that's all they see it as, and like they're going, I want to get off the circuit. And within that, I really dislike it when you do like one of the big weekend clubs, and one of the acts comes on, a pro act with notes. I don't like that at the weekend.
Not if the audience has paid proper money to see a show. It's all, I'm with you on that. For me, it's all about the live clubs and it's kind of a little bit, to be honest, if someone comes on with notes like that and they do well with these new jokes, when the next act comes on who's not using notes and doing good jokes, that seems less impressive because instantly the audience is like, well, you know, this guy's practiced these. The last person hadn't even, there were new ideas. And, right.
I think the weekend just be spent. Then people got a babysitter and a taxi and put on their nice clothes. And it should be a bit special on the weekend, I think.
Yeah, 100%. Like I always do new stuff at new act nights or new material nights and take my notes on. But yeah, I suppose if you're Lee Evans, I suppose that you get to a certain level where that's okay.
So I did I did Pursworth with Lee, where it was at the Glee Clubs. And at the start, when he's getting ready for a big tour, so it's him and Stuart, his writer's called Stuart, and him and Stuart turn up. And it would be, I was always the host, and there would be a first act, and then Lee would go in the middle, and then there would be a closing act afterwards. And then on some times when we'd got further into it, there was just be Lee and then a closer.
Because he got more stuff.
As he got more stuff. And like he was always, he's always nervous, but he was always really well prepared. And he took on tons of notes and ripped through the notes. Like he really, like I took on tons.
Yeah.
And do you know what? And was brilliant. And he would be doing the weekends. That would be the weekends at the Glee Club. But yeah. You know, that guy could have been set. He could have done that at Wembley. You know, he's so popular.
Yeah.
I think it's a different thing. I think he's so popular. Yeah,
because I mean, you get a lot of big acts. They're doing their trying new stuff out in 2,000 seaters.
Yeah.
It's madness, isn't it?
It's funny, but isn't it? This is the thing. When I was quite new as a circus act, when I was relatively new as a circus act, I got told by an older act that the little gigs weren't, don't do the little gigs like you're going to do when you're in the big gigs, and that the little gigs weren't practice for the big gigs, which of course they're not. So just like the angle of your face for in a big
club, right.
Just where you're and stuff like that. And then when I started doing stand up, somebody said to me exactly that. Somebody said to me, like an older act said to me, oh yeah, you know all these little gigs that happen up in the back of a pub? This would be like the 1990s in Manchester, a little gig in the back of a pub. And they're great, but they're not really practiced for the big gigs. And I think that's true, you know. I think that's why you get so many acts that always want to do the Birmingham Glee Club. Because the Birmingham Glee stage is like the Live at the Apollo stage. It is that big stage thing, but in a club setting. So I'm not surprised that those... I've said this for a while. I reckon there are some big acts that... Some big acts come back to the clubs and are fantastic, aren't they? Just come and do the club and, you know, maybe try new material or whatever, or just come for a laugh. But there are some acts I think couldn't come back to the little rooms anymore once they've gone beyond that.
Yeah, so they just wouldn't be used to it. It'd be a complete game check, like gear change back down.
Yeah, and just size of the laughs. And
because you do get some... So on the open mic, so I moved out away from... So when I was new, I'd be in London quite a lot trying stuff out. And then once I started... like playing the bigger clubs, I hardly ever went into London to do those open mic gigs to try stuff, because when I was living in Kent, I'd just find somewhere near Kent. But when I went back to, when I've been living in London and going to these nights, you've got quite a few, so there's quite a few new acts that really smash those little rooms, but they wouldn't be able to play the big rooms because they've kind of worked out how to be good in that small space. But when going into a bigger room, I don't think it'd have the opposite effect. Like, because those London gigs are so crappy. You can work out a way to play them, which is almost sort of, I don't know how to explain it. There's almost like in jokes within the small room setting, trying to be a bit wacky. But if you went into a normal sort of club gig,
because
a
few of my clients for the online stuff are doing what they call those things, gong shows.
Yes.
I'm going, look, this is great because, so I really think, it's changing the subject slightly. I really think having a 2 minute is really useful. People often say, how do you know what 20 minutes feels like? And I go, you don't need to, you just need to know what 2 minutes feels like because they'll show you a light at 20 minutes. So I've been saying to them, do the gong show, write specially for the gong show and feel what the timings are like of a gong show, but don't look at that as it's like a gig, because that's such weird. What a weird.
Yeah. I never did them.
No, I never did. They didn't really have them when I was at that point, but
I go. Yeah, I went to watch the Comedy Store one once when I was really new, and I just knew at the time I wasn't that sort of act. I just knew it wouldn't work. So what's the point?
Yeah, so my thing is, I've always been a bit like this in that, you know, anything that was like very competitive. So I'll be honest, I did used to like I used to do Jonglers, and I used to host Jonglers, and we'd do the Christmas shows. And like now, this time of the year, we'd be like at least 2 or 3 weeks into Christmas shows. We would have started in the middle of November. It was a big run, and they were really gladiatorial gigs. And I really liked that. For like once a year, 1 month a year, I like that. But those things where you're sort of competing with the other acts, like I really don't like that, because it's not meant to be competitive. Like for me, the ideal world is everybody goes on and has a brilliant gig, and everybody raises the bar for the act after them. And if I'm closing the show, the acts before me have done so well, it makes me go, shit, I've got to really, it makes me panic. Yeah. I've got the adrenaline going. And that's what you kind of want, isn't it?
That's because you're a good compere. You've got that attitude.
Yeah, you want that everybody.
Because you want everyone to do well. That's a sign of a good compare.
But also, I think we all should be like, that's professionalism as well, isn't it? Because
surely we should want the people paying money to have such a good night, they want to keep coming back, and then we all get paid, and the industry is great.
So that's what I think happened to some of the gigs that have gone under that weren't so good. Was they'd have some acts that weren't up to it or didn't try, whatever, did badly, maybe just did badly because that happens to us sometimes. Now if, say, 10 people in a 300-seater, 10 people dislike it and they tell their friends on social media, well, that's probably 1,000 people straight up heard it was bad. And if that keeps on happening, that's a lot of people, isn't it, over a period.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. It's bad.
It's funny with stand-up. We are moving into, I think we were just moving into like being a more professional thing. So it was like a kind of a bit punk rock, wasn't it? It was a bit like in the back of a pub, people just trying and no rules. And then we got rules and things sort of formulated and people became like, Edinburgh became like a trade fair for some people. And again, Free Festival came, oh, we got punk rock again. And it was all this thing. And now we've got the, you know, equity, we've got a comedians branch and we've got the Live Comedy Association and starting to get organized. And I think it's good. I think it's become a professional pursuit now, isn't it?
Yeah. It's always sort of up and down, isn't it? In and out. And there's different sorts of circuits as well, I think. So, you know, acts that are better suited for that punk sort of thing, there are gigs for that. And then there's your more sort of professional.
Yeah, and some of it intertwines. Some of it too.
Yeah.
Like for me, so this has happened to me twice. This happened with Circus. I was right there. So it was the early to mid 80s, and it was the non-animal circus. And then that grew into Cirque du Soleil. That grew out of that into Cirque du Soleil. And I think now that's what's happened. But there's still all these offshoots of all the other stuff. And I think that's what's happened with comedy. Like a lot of it's mainstream, the new mainstream. And then there's all these little punk rock things coming up. I think it's great, man.
Yeah. It's awesome. And if you could play everything, that's even better.
Yeah. So I think there's nothing better than the clubs. I think there's nothing better than a good club gig. And I really don't like when people don't respect the clubs, because I think, I feel that's the
peak. That's the bread and butter, isn't it? That's the...
Yeah, and it's the best. And it's why people like, you know, I mentioned like Frankie Boyle, John Bishop, Sarah Mulligan, they all can do the clubs. They could play in any...
The clubs are stand-up comedy. That is where stand-up comedy, that's the home of stand-up comedy.
I reckon between like 200 people and maybe the Birmingham Glee at 450 or whatever that is. That's a particularly small room, I think. But 200 to maybe 300, that's like a proper optimum size, because we can see them and we can see all of them and they can see us. And when it gets in them big rooms, like I often say, once it's over 1,000, it could be 10,000 and it wouldn't make any difference. It's just so...
It's a different thing altogether, isn't it?
Watching you on watching Michael McIntyre on a big screen or Peter Kay on a...
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. Yeah, weird one, but yeah.
Yeah. So joke-wise, routines and things, have you got any over the years that have just... It's kind of bothered you because you really like the idea but could never quite manage to get it to work?
Yeah. Generally, it's because I've moved on too quickly. And I had a valuable lesson in this at one point years ago. So do you know Kevin Gildee?
No.
Kevin Gildee's a very, very interesting Irish comedian, a really good comedian.
Okay.
And he was on with me at a gig, and he did this story about a guy going into the lion's den. And he had like a whole 10 minutes about this guy that climbed into the zoo, into the lion's den. And really good. And I said to him, did you not used to do that as like a one-liner short joke? And he said, yeah, I did. And it never worked. And I didn't realize, I put it away because I thought, I'm not good enough yet to do that joke. And then I revisited it. And I thought, God, I never revisited stuff. Now I do that. Now I go through, I did throw a load of notebooks away at one point. So I did an Edinburgh show with 10 years worth of notebooks, which was a pile of notebooks. And I'd let the audience pick one. I had a game that I played with the audience, and if they
won, oh, that's fun.
They picked the notebook and they opened the notebook, and whatever was that, I told them that bit of material. And now,
oh, I like that. That's nice.
Yeah, it was fun. It was a fun thing to do. Do you know what was interesting? It was exhausting. It was really exhausting because genuinely not knowing what the material was coming was different than if they'd just give you a subject or something.
Did they kind of did you have fun with that fact that you don't know what it is? So I'm sure they're probably more forgiving as well because it's got this anarchic kind of feel to it.
What is, and at the end of the show, I did a stage dive. It was completely anarchic. That was the whole plan. And the thing that I noticed there, which I don't do anymore, and that was, it was a good bit of the learning curve, this bit, was so many of those notebooks had titles that sounded interesting titles, but I had no idea what I meant by it. So in the show, I would improvise the story. It was almost like I was doing set list or something. It was all like,
oh, right, yeah.
Some of them I knew the material straight away because it'd be my club set. But a lot of that would just be an interesting title. And I think, oh, that sounds interesting. Why wasn't that a joke? So now I've got to a point where if I write something down, I put some effort into it. I try to get it finished rather than just let it drift away to something else.
Yeah. Yeah, I did that. I've started doing that a lot more now, is going through old ideas. Because I think if there's a funny idea, there's a way of making it work.
Yeah.
Have you got any examples of old bits that you've had?
I picked up, they tend to not be written out enough. So I picked up this thing, an old notebook. You know, there's a joke in here that I've written into several shows, and it's not even a joke, it's a true story. And
right.
About my mate, one of my mates that bought a Porsche. And I found it in this notebook, and it's never been done on stage. But I've written it down so many
times,
and it's never, I wonder why.
Is that because deep down you haven't got the confidence in it?
I don't know, because it's the kind of thing that it's the kind of thing that would suit me. So I'll tell you what it is.
Yeah.
So in brief, when I was much younger, a friend of mine put all his money into buying a Porsche. He put all his money into buying a secondhand Porsche, and he was doing that, paying it up every month. And it meant all his money went on it. He paid his rent, he got his food, and he got his Porsche, and that was that. And he'd never go for night outs. And he said it was he's called Nigel, and he said it was great because just having those keys with Porsche on them, you just put them on a bar, and women think you're fantastic. And I was going, yeah, okay, mate, that's a bit silly. And then he told me a story that he'd gone out in Belfast, he'd gone to a posh bar in Belfast, and he put the keys on the bar, and a really attractive woman had come up and started flirting with him, chatting up. She said, look, shall we just cut to the chase? I think we should go back to my place. And he's gone, yes, the Porsche has worked. She told him where he lived, where she lived, and he didn't have money enough for petrol to get there. So that's what I think, it's a perfectly nice little story.
Yeah, that's a good idea. But when you were saying it, I was trying to think where you were going to go with it. And because my instant thought was, like, he wouldn't be able to go out with her.
Yeah.
Because he wouldn't be able to afford a meal or anything like that.
You know those,
that's great.
You know those jokes like that? So I like things like that. And there's a thing of, you know, when you tell a story and then the punchline part of it is completely unexpected. They didn't expect it at all, and that's where the laughter is. You know, when there's a story like this, I've got a couple of stories like this, that they sort of know where you're going because you've made a human contact with them, and they understand where you're going. And then they're laughing because of the familiarity of it. I like those jokes as well.
But also, you can get the surprise from the angle you go for, because I didn't see you going for petrol.
Mm.
So you going for petrol made me laugh because that wasn't what I was thinking in my head.
Mm.
So that's nice. With that, a lot of your stuff comes from true stories. Would you ever change it to say, because that would quite easily work as you.
Mm.
So if you were the Porsche guy.
Yeah, so like, I would only change it to me. So generally, I'm really very much doing it from true stories.
Mm.
And I would only change it to me if I had something that was really good, but that needed the person to be a dickhead, and I was making me be the dickhead. I want to make the other person. So that's quite funny.
So rather than sort of punching down at that person.
So I want that story, like, as I say, so I've told you there in a kind of off the top of my head form.
That's exactly what happened. Yeah.
I would want that story to be that I still, it's kind of, I like him and this is funny because this Egypt did this.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Idiot rather than a dickhead is what I would be going for. But that,
okay, yeah.
This is one of my the thing that's happened to me is, I ran out of stories. So because
yeah, of course,
all true stories, and so the last few years, I've had to force the stories to happen. I've had to put myself in situations to make a story happen. So for example, this year's Edinburgh was called At the Edge. And the idea was that I was going to do the Perth and Western Australia Festival, Fringe World. I'd do the Adelaide Fringe. I had some other work on an Aboriginal community. And then I was going to go back to Adelaide and I was going to ride my bike across the Great Australian bike, my push bike. I was going to cycle across Australia. And I'd allowed 2 weeks to do it, which is, long enough. And I was going to camp and I was going to write the show from what experiences happened and who I met and there's truck stops and stuff. And then that got derailed by the bushfires. Do you remember they had bushfires?
Oh, yeah.
Start? And then I wrote some stuff about bushfires and about how I was going to do this. And then when I did do Perth, me and my friend Logie, that I do a double act, an Irish guy called Logie Logan, we do a circus act together called Dirty Tattooed Circus Bastards. And we we drove that road and it was fine. So then I scheduled that I was going to do it again. So now I'm going to finish Adelaide. I'm going to go and do the work. I'm going to fly back to Perth and I'm going to ride it the other way and end up in Adelaide. Rescheduled that and got closed down by COVID. So I then came back. So I wrote that. So I wrote something about that. I then came back to the UK and I thought, this is no bother at all. This will be fine. I'll do Land's End to John O'Groats. I invited a couple of other comedians I know that cycle. We were going to do Land's End to John O'Groats. We were going to do the National Three Peaks. I started writing about that, and then lockdown happened. So that Edinburgh show was two-thirds written about things that I was going to do that I couldn't do because of these things.
I mean, that's all of a sudden you've got structure out of nowhere.
Yeah, yeah. It just did it on its own. And then, of course, nothing happened.
Because then you can go into So will you still use that for the next one, like as an idea?
I don't hang on to them. I really don't.
Really?
Some years I've written a show for the Glasgow Comedy Festival and had it ready. So that's March. And I would do the Glasgow Comedy Festival. And that was the start of it. That would be that year's Edinburgh show. And I've written a new show. I've done that show and it's gone well. And then I've just written another show because I felt it was done and moved. I like keeping moving on. So with Edinburgh, sometimes in Edinburgh, I've chucked half a show away halfway through the festival and done a different end.
Why? Because you're bored or because you're just not happy with it?
I'm not bored, but when I feel that I'm not, when I feel like it, so I tell you exactly this. A friend of mine said to me a couple of years ago, what had happened was I'd done a lot of overseas gigs, and overseas gigs, there's a certain flavor to the performance that I would do in that I'm an Irishman in Canada. I'm an Irish on tour in Australia and this thing. And so there's a certain flavor to that. And so in the club sets I was doing there, I was doing the same set every time. So I came back and was on in the UK circuit with a really solid set. And one of my friends said to me, oh, you've got a really bulletproof set. And I thought, oh no, that means it's dead. And and it's exactly that. It almost feels like as soon as it's ready, as soon as it's working, well, that's it starting to die then. And so you need to start thinking about the next bit.
Right. That almost feels like a shame, doesn't it? You've worked hard to get this bit sort of finished. And then, there's a lot of acts that are complete opposite and they get their 20 minutes and they won't ever change that.
So I think when you see people do that, Mark, you see people that do that where they got their first fully pro 20 written and it's great. And they got a proper great 20 and then they do it forever. And you go, what happened to that thing that wrote that 20? So for me, I think it's less of the thing, the set, and it's more of them making the set. So Adam Bloom said, you know Adam, right? Adam Bloom, a fantastic joke writer, I think, and very astute about comedy. Adam said a really great thing to me. We were sitting in, we'd done a gig together, hadn't seen each other for ages. And by chance on the way home, we'd stopped at the same petrol station and we stood and we were talking to each other at the petrol station. And I'd said something that I'd done in the show. And I said, I've got that joke that I did. It hadn't really worked. And I was going, it's nearly working, but it's not quite working. And Adam said, oh, that's the best bit. And I thought, that is kind of the best bit, because it's like hope and
possibility. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that moment, it does work, the feeling.
Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah, that's interesting, because yes, because with me, I always do a different Edinburgh show every year, and then my club set just evolves. So I'll just stick in the bits I want from that show just to add to it. So as long as I'm constantly evolving the club set, I'm happy. I couldn't just do the same. I still do some jokes that I did ages ago and they come in and out of my set. Mm. But I like that I've got parts of my club set that I look forward to, which are the new bits. And that keeps me motivated. And that's why I do Edinburgh every year, because it just makes that set better. Because for me, it's like we were saying earlier, the club set is the most important thing for me. So I use Edinburgh to get a better club set. That tends to be my motivation usually. Because I'm not an Edinburgh act in, I've got this story of this adventure, like acts like yourself, where you've got a whole set thing there, and that's something to be proud of. My stuff's all one-liners, so I do that new show just so that I can keep getting that set as strong as possible.
So it's interesting with that. So how long did you, if you had an idea for a joke, like I was saying there, you go, oh, it's nearly ready, it's getting some laughs, but I think it's better. How long would you work on that for?
I mean, that could be years. It just depends. It won't be constant, but if it doesn't hit well, I won't keep it in, and I haven't worked out how to improve it in that short space of time. I'll put that in a notepad and come back to it at another time. And it is amazing how many, like literally today, I was doing the podcast with Josh Pugh earlier, and there's a joke I've been working on for ages, and he just said something. I was like, oh my God, why did I not, that's so clear, so obvious. It was so the joke was the joke I'd written was my nan was against me cage fighting, but in the end I beat her, and it never quite hit. And I said to him, I think it's because it's not very, essentially it's not really what the joke's about, but at the end of it it's violence on an old woman, essentially. And he just said, why doesn't she beat you? And I went, of course she beats me.
Yeah.
But of course that's funnier.
Yeah.
Because she's an old lady and it's self-deprecating. But that, I've been coming back and forward for about, that is for the new show, that joke, but I know it's a good joke. So I have kept coming back to it, trying to, and then sometimes it works really well and it does the next time, and then the next two times it doesn't. And for me, that's not consistent enough, like for me. So, but now I'm excited again because I get to work on that.
Yeah. So it's different, isn't it, about with short jokes? Because Stuart Francis and I were sitting talking about jokes, and I'd said to him that I normally would give a joke like three outings on good nights, and if I wasn't really loving it, I'd probably just move on. And he said he gives something a year. He'll have something for you. But it is different, isn't it? Because quite often, in the way I do things, the laughs are going along, whereas yours has to laugh, start again. Yeah.
Yeah. So it has to be a certain hit. Otherwise, it's nothing and it's noticeable. Whereas if you're sort of keeping them up and up and up, it doesn't really matter if a little bit dips a bit, because you're flowing, aren't you?
Yeah, so I get that. I this is one of the things I do in my tutorials. I say to people to look at imagine the audio spikes. And so in your style, the audio spikes and then drops right down and then starts again.
Whereas it's like reset.
For my style, the storytelling style, I can come in halfway through and get another little laugh, and I can get a succession of little laughs of the energy of the first laugh. So they might not work. They might not get a big laugh on their own, but when you coast them off a bigger laugh, they get they would on their they're more than the sum of their parts then.
So if you gigged with Stuart Francis a lot?
Not when he was... years, man. Not for years and years. We used to see each other a lot.
I did get in contact with him because I you know, I'd love to have him on, but he's retired now. Yeah. He's in France or somewhere, is he?
That Stuart used to look at stuff. So I look at stuff in great detail because of my... So I look at a lot of movement-based stuff, as I know Tom State does as well. When Tom started doing TV stuff, he used to always say to me about recording things, and then he'd say that he'd video it and so that he could see his movements. I'm very into the idea of movements and how we physically on stage. And Stuart Francis and I, when we were talking this one particular occasion, you know, he's got that bit of chipmunk material and he was very specific about how he holds his hands.
Right.
And I think there's, so I think for you guys, there needs to be something that breaks the pattern. And something like when Gary Delaney brings out his letter, and it is a physical thing. When you speak to the audience and introduce live interaction thing, Stuart, when he introduces the other character, so it's no longer just him talking. Well, Stephen Wright in the famous old Stephen Wright joke routine, you know, Stephen Wright, the American, one-liners, brilliant one-liners. He would do like a standard joke for about 40 minutes into an hour. He'd have an actual gag, an actual, I was on the bus the other day and this guy came on and he'd do an actual gag. And it's because there's a point, isn't there, where that joke's too much.
Yeah, yeah. So everyone sort of, everyone has their own way to reset the audience. That's how I see it. You're resetting them back to when they started.
So when you do your thing, this is me thinking back to when I saw you and really enjoyed seeing you that new year, 10 years ago, which was only a year ago.
I know.
So when you do your, when you go into the audience, and did you say something like, tell, what are you interested in? And then you did a joke.
Yeah. So I tend to, I'll set it up. So I'll tell them, I'll ask you a question, and then I'll do a joke about it. So I tell them I'm going to do a joke about it. So what that does is that allows me to fail, because if they say something after I've set it up like that and then I can't think of anything, I can go, just do that, and that will get a laugh.
Yeah.
Because I've set myself up to fail.
Yeah.
Whereas if I just chatted to them and said, what's your hobby? And they said, hockey. And I went, that wouldn't get anything. They would just think I'm rubbish. But so sometimes I set it up like that, just so there's an out, just in case I can't think of anything.
Yeah.
And then with the jokes, like you said earlier, it's either there's a joke from the arsenal that I put out, or I'll improvise a joke in the moment, depending on what it is.
Because I do it. So I, in an ideal world, a perfect setup of a club set, I say to them, pick a country and I'll tell you a story about it. And they say a country, and I either can genuinely tell a story about it, or I've got a story that's really closely related. So if somebody says Bolivia, I've got a joke about Peru. If somebody said Portugal, I've probably got a joke about Spain. So they're really closely related. But with your thing, when you improvise, so occasionally I'll improvise something within that. Mm. Mostly it's material, but occasionally I will improvise something. Do you improvise off the word of their job, or the way that they say the sentence to you, or whatever they say? So if you've said, what sport do you like? Do you improvise off their reply, or do you improvise off the hockey?
So my initial thing is the actual sport, because then I can just go into my bank and go, I'll take that one, and then do that one.
Hmm.
But then if they say it in a funny way, or use in weird language, or it's a sport that I'm not used to, or I can think of some wordplay, like as a way to respond to them, if there's wordplay in that. So, for example, can I think of an example? Like, for example, if they worked in IT, I improvised once this and it worked, so I do it every time it happens. If they say they work in IT, I stick my fist out and I go, word. So I get them to do the fist bump.
Yeah.
And I say word. So that, I like those because that's not a joke, but that is an improvised response that I could say to that answer.
Yeah.
But it also matches what they said.
Yeah, nice.
So they're my favourite ones because they're the ones I genuinely improvise in the moment.
Yeah. And they're extra texture to it. They're an additional texture to the layers of the show. I do a thing where if I say to them, pick a country, and they say somewhere that isn't immediately, quite often I'm fighting against the urge just to splurge straight into a story. So if country that I've obviously got a story that I know I've got a story about, and it's a strong story, I'm often fighting the urge to do that, to try and make something else happen. Mm. I'll often say, if they said Peru, I'll go, oh, Peru, is there a reason you've chosen Peru? And I'm trying to improvise off knowing I've got Peru, knowing I've got...
Yeah, if you've got that in the bank, that's... Yeah, exactly. If I know I've got a solid gag in the bank, I would happily try and ring something out.
Yeah. That's a thing, yeah. Thing that came to me. That came to me through experience. I don't think I ever consciously... I think I consciously didn't want to do the stories all the time. The obvious... Not the obvious countries, but the popular countries that would come up all the time. And I think it was a way to try and get more to happen than that. But it was never a conscious, here's a joke.
Because if you get something else out of them that you've got something on, all of a sudden you've got an entire, your whole set could be about that because you could lead in one into the other and always come back to Peru's story, at the end.
Taking these opportunities, I think this is why we like live comedy, isn't it? I don't judge things against each other, but those acts that do the same set every time and they're fantastic, that's a certain skill set. But for me, I think it's that them little sparkly moments where something happens and you've got something that you didn't even know you were going to say it.
I did the Bearcat the other night, and it was the first one back since the second lockdown. And I did my usual sort of joke, and then I went into the audience, and I just stayed in the. I was on stage, and I was just thinking to myself, I'm having so much fun here, because I'm chatting to them, I'm improvising jokes, that's fun. I don't know what's going to happen. You got the adrenaline, and I was at my happiest at that point. I loved it.
Yeah, yeah.
So fun.
Yeah, it's good. I used to do a thing where So I really love that. I used to do a thing where I had a big visual closer of the show. And it was always my closer of the show. And so I had a prop act when I was first doing stand-up. I did props. And it let you do that improvising because you always knew you had that big closer. And then my son, Smug Roberts, I don't know if you know Smug Roberts. Manchester act. He don't do it much.
Yeah, I do know him, yeah.
Mostly an actor. He did two things, two different routines when Jonglers and Highlights days. And both those, one was him as a dad. So he's somebody's dad, he's got kids. And so he's been the dad and he was dancing to S Club 7. And that was in the charts at the time. And it was really well done, beautifully done. Mm. And I've never, when he did that in Manchester Jonglers, and I was hosting and I went on after him. One night there, I'd never seen a bigger response to anything. And like, I've been on stage introducing like big rock bands at the festivals. And and it literally was like they blew my hair back. They loved it so much. But both he and I sat for a long time, on many occasions, talking about comedy. And we both had realized separately that having a big finisher was letting you get away with murder. In the bit up to it, you knew they were going to be happy by the finisher. They knew that big closer was going to make them happy. And it meant that we weren't doing as good. You needed that kind of fear a little bit.
Yes.
To make the juices flow or something.
Yeah, it's similar, I suppose, to once you're famous and you kind of can rely on just being famous and then your material isn't as solid as it once would have had to be.
Yeah, so I don't know. I heard this second or even third hand. But when Harry Hill got famous, so Al Murray was telling me one time that in Harry Hill's house, so Al Murray, when he started being the pub landlord, So productive. Like, on the before that, he'd been a sound effects act, and he started being the pub landlord, and he was so productive. Like every month when I would go to London, like once or twice a month, if I seen him in London, he'd have a brand new 20. He was so productive. It was like somebody had opened the pressure valve and stuff came out, and it's fantastic. And I said, you're writing so much. He said, yeah, until I was at Harry Hill's house and I saw all of his shelves full of notebooks of jokes. And then I thought, oh, that's amazing, isn't it? I like that guy. Why? It's good that he's writing so much. And then I heard this, the bit that I heard second or third hand, was that when Harry Hill had his break and he was getting TV and stuff, he'd all the time in London in those days, if you saw another or act to be announced, it was always Harry Hill. But he'd right. to the point where he'd do that mannerism, whatever that thing is he does, and they'd laugh. And he couldn't tell if the jokes were working anymore. I always thought that, you know, for somebody with all those books of jokes, all those notebooks, all that productivity, to suddenly not was genuinely working. That's like the kind of curse. That's like the gypsy's curse, isn't it?
Yeah.
You'll keep writing that's jokes, funny. You'll never know if they're funny enough.
Because it's not quite the same, because obviously I'm not famous like Harry Hill, and I don't do that kind of wackiness. But whenever I do new material, I usually keep the mic in the stand and do very little performance, just so I know how strong the bit is.
Right.
Because if it stands up on its own without me performing it, then I know it's definitely going to be good.
Hmm.
But it's not quite, obviously it's not quite the same, but still the same logic.
Hmm. So that's a really interesting thing to do. I love it. I realized with myself. So this came up at one point. I put a thing on Facebook once in one of the forums, and I said, when you have those comedians that are compares, but they don't do any jokes at all, they're not doing any jokes at all, what are they? And somebody said, oh, they're cheerleaders, aren't they? And I thought, oh, that's good. And working with those cheerleader hosts, MCs, you're going to have a great night. But I was what are they as comedians? Why are they not being a comedian? Why are they being a cheerleader? And like, don't get me wrong, they're doing a fantastic job. You'll have a brilliant night. But I thought, well, why don't they want to do some of their jokes? And then I identified in myself, I tend to do this. I see something in others and I look to see in myself. So now you've said that, putting the thing in the mic stand and just leaving it. If I had a gig on Thursday, I'd do that and just see what.
Okay, cool.
I'd do it immediately just to see what it felt like, if I had the freedom to it.
Yeah, yeah, nice.
And I realized that because, so like big beards are less, so anyone listening, I've got a big beard. They're less unusual now, but I've had this for 25 years. I'm normally an unusual looking big character in a room. And I know that I can do well just with strength of personality and that performance skills. And so that stops being enough after a while. After a while, you go, oh, well, I learned that. I probably learned that. Like, you can learn 3 or 4 years in, you've learned that. So I thought, it needs to stand. So I sometimes now try and make it stand up on paper so that if it was read, it's still funny. And it's not that I'm saying it in my accent or my rhythm. Or
Yeah,
so it stands alone on paper as an interesting exercise.
Mm, because then you add that to your look. All of a sudden, you've got a massive bit.
Sometimes you've got something else. So, you know, I occasionally write for other comedians and some stuff. You know, this expression, that's not right at the minute, but I'll put it in the drawer. And so you go, you get a commission and you go, oh, well, I've got a book of jokes. And you can say, oh, that suits that guy. This will suit that perfectly. So I think it is that if it's just... If it's just written on, you know, those acts that write on stage and that works for them. I think if it doesn't, for me, if I can't do it here at home, just doing it on stage isn't enough. I need to do it at home.
Yeah, same.
On the page. But I did do an Edinburgh show once that I didn't write down. I tried that as an experiment once and it did work. I did an Edinburgh show that was a true story that had a logical progression, like it. Told as a true story, it was a journey, and I never wrote that show down and barely changed the whole month. It was an interesting exercise. Yeah,
I just went with it,
but it was a big story, so that was partly the thing, was because it was a big true story, that was partly why it worked.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Martin Moore! How do you like it?
How do you like it?
Is
more,
that the words?
More. Yeah.
How do you like it?
How do you like my love?
And if you want to let us know how you like it, let us know the feedback at Jokes with Mark. Across all social media, we'd love to hear from you. I moved my phone out of the way because you said that it might have been causing feedback, but I've just got it back in front of me, Joel. And we had some feedback last week, a little bit, and I remembered that someone sent some feedback, and I had a look. So on Twitter, under the post I made about the Simon Lomas episode, had lots of nice feedback, actually. Not just sort of, the feedback I'm going to tell you now is, you know, about one of the jokes, but a lot of people said to me, this is a really good episode. So
oh, happy days.
I'm glad everyone's enjoying it. I went to see a specialist about my sleep cycle. He gave me some stabilisers. I think that's actually all right.
That's
from J Cloth 74 underscore J, if that is his real name.
Have you been had there? Is that a bit of a huge ass?
J Cloth. Good name. Good name. I wonder what he's good hiding. Name. He's hiding something. His profile picture is a J Cloth. And 40, he's got 48 followers.
Yep.
Do I know any of them? I don't know any of them. Don't know any of them.
J Cloth, man of mystery.
Bow ties. He's Talent Jones. No, don't know any of these people. And he's following. Oh, he's following quite a few people. He's following Tim Vine. So he likes the old one-liners. Ah, interesting. Let us know if you know J Cloth's true identity. get in touch at Jokes with Mark across all social media. I'd love to hear from you. There we go. So, Jolie boy.
Marky Mark,
if you enjoy this episode, do you enjoy any episode? We have plenty of bonus content over on Patreon. You can go and sign up over there at patreon.com/jokeswithmark. Anything you're looking at your face, Joel, thinking you might want to say something else before we leave?
No, I think I'm all out.
Well, we had a lovely review on Apple Podcasts, and I'd bloody love it if we could have some more reviews over there.
Some more reviews.
Some more Apple Podcast reviews.
Good
so
stuff.
If you could go over, thanks mate. If you go over there and give us a 5-star review, we would much appreciate that. And you know, if not, just we're just glad you're listening and having a good time. Oh. So, Joel, anything more from you, Joel?
Nothing more from me, Mark. Anything more from you, Mark?
Nothing more from me, Joe. Hashtag Aruga, everybody.
Hold up.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.